It's 9 a.m. and you're listening to 88.5 WHBK-FM Chicago, the pride of the South Side. How do I, Sports Talk Chicago is now on the air. Welcome, my name is John Zaglul, and I'll be your host for the next hour as we break down Chicago sports. Now, first of all, I'd like to thank the University of Chicago, our station manager Nick Varley, and public affairs director Sam Larson for this great opportunity to talk sports with you. I'd like to introduce myself first and give you a bit of a background on me. I'm a first-year student here at the university, and I've also been the host and creator of SportsTalkChicago.com for the past 5 years. I've also done play-by-play football and basketball broadcasting for Victor J. Andrew High School in Tinley Park, Illinois. Now, currently, I'm a staff reporter for 22nd Century Media, which is an official paper down in the South Suburbs, an officially accredited MLB and NFL writer, and the public address announcer for the Windy City Thunderbolts professional baseball franchise. So, Sports Talk Chicago is just that. We're going to dissect some local sports with you, as well as track some national stories right here on 88.5 WHPK-FM Chicago. All music intros and songs are produced and performed by TMMRW, and he's on all music platforms, including Spotify and iTunes. So when you have an opportunity after the show, if you like what you've heard, make sure to check him out. Now, the phone lines are open. That's what I'm really looking forward to today at 773-702-8424. That's 773-702-8424. So if you have some thoughts, if you don't agree, if you agree with what I'm saying, feel free to call, I'll answer, and we could put you on the air and debate some sports. So, today we have a very good show planned for you, something that I'm really looking forward to personally because we're getting into some baseball, football, and basketball. We have a special guest coming on later around 9:40, and this is a guy who grew up right here on the south side of Chicago, made it to the NBA, played for about 10 or 11 years, and now is back in Florida and Chicago. So we'll talk to him about his great basketball career, what it meant to him growing up here in Chicago, plus his participation in the Big Three basketball tournament run by Ice Cube and Jeff Quatinetz. And then we'll have a best of SportsTalkChicago.com montage, and I'm really looking forward to that as well. We'll be playing some interview clips from my podcast on my website. We've got some great clips ready. Michael Vick, Roger Clemens, so many different people. So again, I really hope you stay tuned for that as well coming up later on in the show. But first, let's talk about September 3rd. Okay, now I remember September 3rd like it was yesterday. And that's not because of some personal news or anything like that, but because on September 3rd, the Chicago Cubs had a 5-game division lead in the NL Central. And today, just over a month later, the Cubs are now sitting at home watching the MLB postseason on TV. Now, you have to ask, why and what happened? Let's put it that way. What happened to the Cubs, and why are they now at home just a month after leading the division by 5 games? I mean, the division was considered over, let's put it that way. And I know that the Cardinals and Brewers ended up creeping back in later in the year, but At the beginning of September, the Cubs were the consensus favorites. I remember going on Twitter, looking at various polls, people talking about how they know the Cubs are going to win the division. There's no doubt in their minds. And yet today, they had to play in game 163. They lose the wild card game outright. And now they're out of the playoffs entirely. And their year is over. So let me go back to the beginning of the year in February or March. Let's put it that way. Now, the Cubs were supposed to win the division by six games. That's according to the Pecota projection system. And if you're not familiar, they're a system that's based off of baseballprospectus.com. And what they do every year is they have a mathematical system. They run the numbers and they predict who's going to win each division, how many wins each team's going to get. And, you know, sometimes they're accurate, sometimes they're not. They did have the Cubs, though, in the year they won the 2016 World Series, winning 101 games and the division. And, of course, that year, the Cubs won 103 games and won the division, of course, then the World Series itself. So I do trust what they say. So again, February and March, the Cubs were supposed to win the division by six games, according to the Pecota projection system. The Cardinals were supposed to finish in second, and the Brewers were supposed to actually come in third, which obviously that didn't turn out the way they wanted it to. But it's a shame because the Cubs this year, I feel like, had a chance to really go far in the playoffs. I mean, when you look at the National League right now and you look at the playoff picture, there's no one that really scares you. Now, maybe the Brewers because they've caught lightning in a bottle, but, you know, the Dodgers, the Braves, the Rockies, who are now eliminated after winning that wild card game and getting swept by the Brewers, none of those teams are necessarily intimidating. The Dodgers didn't even win 90 games, for crying out loud. They won 88. And you have to wonder now, you know, how far could the Cubs have gone when you think about them making it into the playoffs and moving far? I feel like if the Cubs had been able to stick around past the wild card, they could have made it somewhere. I think they could have went to the World Series because, in the end, I think they could have beaten the Brewers if we're talking a Game 7 matchup or a best-of-seven series in the NLCS. And it's funny because when you compare that to the American League, you've got three teams in the AL who have won 100 games, which I think is something that is just unbelievable. I mean, it's the first time that's ever happened in the history of the game. Three teams winning 100 games in the same league. You had the Oakland A's with 96 wins, the same total as the Brewers. They were in the second wild card spot. Then you've got teams like the Rays and the Mariners. Rays winning 90 games, which is unprecedented, and they miss out on the playoffs entirely. So comparing the AL to the NL, I mean, it's not even a comparison. The NL is much weaker. If the Cubs had been able to make a real push and make a real run, I think they could have went far. But let's detail the team's struggles and what happened to them this year, because it's a great question. Now, first of all, offensively, and this was this stat that was thrown up during the wild card game, the Cubs had lost, it was something like 40 games, or they were in 41 run games, and the only team that had done that before or this year was the Orioles. The Orioles lost 118 games this year, and the Cubs somehow ended up winning 95. But anyways, the offensive production was atrocious. And you had Wilson Contreras to start, the catcher. He had 249 this year. This was the worst year of his career. And what I find ironic about that is the guy makes the All-Star team. He's hitting around 290 at nine home runs. So the power's not there, but at least the average is, and once he made it, his second half was just horrible. Anthony Rizzo didn't heat up until the second half of the year, which obviously is a problem because that first half the Cubs wasted entirely. Javier Baez was the bright spot. We'll get to him later on when we talk about the NL MVP race. Addison Russell getting suspended and Chris Bryant being hurt. Schwarber didn't put up the year that people were expecting, and I'm so happy about that because I had predicted that way before, that everyone was freaking out about Schwarber and the fact that he had lost so much weight, but in the end, it still didn't really make a difference. He had 238, so it's not like there was anything impressive there. Albert Almora, another guy who cooled off, and then Jason Hayward. So the offense didn't help matters whatsoever. You heard me name those guys. Lots of those guys were in slumps in the second half of the year, and then Rizzo, of course, in the first half. But the pitching itself, too, wasn't that good. And I know Kyle Hendricks, John Lester, they kind of anchored that rotation. Lester had a great year, and if it wasn't for that six-week stretch in July going into August, we could be talking about him as a possible Cy Young winner. But anyways, the thing that got me really mad about the Cubs and their pitching situation is the fact that Yu Darvish and Tyler Chatwood were complete wastes of money. Now, Darvish himself, this year, he went 1-3, an ERA just under 5, and a WAR of negative 0.2, and I know he was hurt for the rest of the year, but this is a guy who's getting paid, you know, $20, $25 million a year, he gets rewarded. And by the way, that's the one thing that I'm wondering is how this guy got rewarded for doing so bad last year. I mean, Darvish went 10-12 in the regular season, and I know wins and losses don't mean much. His ERA was around 3.9, which, okay, is decent. It's average. He's an average pitcher in the major leagues. But we all remember what happened in the postseason that year with the Dodgers in the World Series. I mean, he imploded. He kind of blew the World Series almost single-handedly if it wasn't for Brandon Morrow, another guy the Cubs signed, ironically enough. So it makes you wonder why a team like the Cubs would go out and decide to get him. So Darvish this year, not too good. And another guy I'd love to talk about, because this is just, you know, the bell of the ball, what a horrible signing it is Tyler Chatwood. 4-6 record, 5.30 ERA. Now, what baffles me is that his WAR is 0.0, which you'd think would be negative based on the year that he had. Think about this for a minute and put this into perspective. Tyler Chatwood led all of Major League Baseball in walks with 95, okay? And he only pitched in 103 and two-thirds innings. Think about that for a minute. Chatwood was benched, halfway through the year, and in the end, it didn't even matter. He still led the league in walks. That's horrible. This is the guy who's making $14 million a year, and he's walking all the time, or walking batters, rather. And I equate Tyler Chatwood and Yu Darvish to probably two of the worst signings that the Epstein and Hoyer era have managed, that and the Edwin Jackson signing. But I know that was during the rebuild, and they didn't care whether they won or lost, and Jackson ended up making them lose more than win. But those three signings in and of themselves were the worst signings the Epstein era has ever made. And unfortunately, both of those signings, and Chatwood and Darvish, occurred this year, and they hurt the Cubs this year, without a doubt. So that was a problem for them. Now, this year, after the collapse, you've got questions surrounding Joe Maddon, right? And you've got people wondering, is he going to be asked back? Because right now, the Cubs and him are kind of in a publicized dispute over whether he'll get extended past 2019. And right now, I have to say, it's not looking good for his tenure. I mean, Maddon has led the team to a winning season every year, and I'll give him that. You know, they've won 90-plus games every year, but in the end, you know, they have to make it back to the World Series. This was their year to make it back. I know he dealt with a lot, and that's going to be a problem for him come, you know, later on in his contract dispute and his contract talks. But, you know, it was just a shame that the Cubs couldn't take advantage of this year and make something out of it. So, you know, I feel like the Cubs, they didn't end up making things happen this year. They had opportunities that they squandered. We all remember the wild card game, and now, you know, they're going to be stuck and suffering this entire offseason, wondering what went wrong and wondering how they can improve come next year. The Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family offers free breast and cervical cancer screenings and low-cost treatment for uninsured women over 35, regardless of income. Screenings cost nothing and could save you everything. You can find more information on this at cancerscreening.illinois.gov or calling 888-522-1282. That's 888-522-1282. This is Sports Talk Chicago right here on WHBK 88.5 FM. You just heard me talk about the Cubs. We're getting to the Bears next. But if you have any thoughts, if you have any concerns, or you disagree with me and you want to debate right here on the air, you give me a call at 773-702-8424. Again, that's 773-702-8424. So let's move on now, shift gears to some football, move away from the discouraging Cubs news, and talk about some Chicago Bears news and what they've done this year, because I'll tell you what, it's been a surprise. And I talked to David Kaplan of ESPN 1000 on my podcast last week, and he told me that back in January and February, he was saying the Bears were going to win 9 games and be okay. And everyone would make fun of him about it, and people would, you know, cause him problems. But now, I mean, he's looking like a genius. And I think that his predictions ended up, you know, paving the way for what happened this year. Look at the Bears right now. They're 3-1. And, you know, it's the first time since 2013 that the Bears have started a season 3-1. And if you could recall that year, that was the year that Josh McCown caught lightning in a bottle. He threw for 14 touchdowns and one interception. He had to compete with Jay Cutler, and I remember there was a QB controversy. There was people wondering, maybe McCown's the guy for the Bears, which, of course, you know, that's crazy in and of itself. But, you know, it makes you wonder, is this going to be a special season for the Bears come through this year? Now, the defense, obviously, has been a focal point for the team right now. No question about it. I mean, Khalil Mack has just wreaked havoc on opposing teams and their quarterbacks. Right now, Mack, he was named Defensive Player of the Month for the NFC, and so far through four games only, four forced fumbles and five sacks. That is just unheard of in regards to defensive statistics. And it's so funny because, I don't know if you had ended up seeing, it was about a week or two after Mack made his debut for the Bears, people were asking John Gruden, the coach of the Oakland Raiders, about, you know, what are you guys doing right now in regards to defense? You guys have some problems. And he's like, yeah, you know, it's hard to find a good pass rusher. It's like, you know, man, you had a pass rusher. He was pretty darn good. He was one of the best in the league. You gave him up, and now the Bears are cashing in. And it's rare to see a guy come to Chicago and not do bad. I mean, we remember Julius Peppers and Jared Allen. Those guys really didn't do that well for the Bears. But it's nice to see Khalil Mack come here and make something happen and do well with the contract that he was given. So the defense has been a focal point, and it reminds me personally of the 2006 Bears team that made it to the Super Bowl and lost to the Colts and Peyton Manning. I remember, you know, that year they had so many good players, Charles Tillman anchoring that defense. You had Brian Urlacher, now a first ballot Hall of Famer, Brendan Iambadagio, him on defense, and then special teams. There were so many good players on that team. So they had a great defense. They had a very good running game. And people, I think, forget about Thomas Jones and the role that he played that year. I mean, he rushed for over 1,000 yards. They had Cedric Benson and him splitting carries, and he still rushed for over 1,000. Still was one of the best running backs in the game, I would argue, that season. But they had a bad quarterback. And that was Rex Grossman. And if you all remember, Rex Grossman at the time was not the sharpest tool in the shed. That year with the Bears, he did start in all 16 games, but he had 23 touchdowns, 20 picks, and a completion percentage under 55%. Now, does that draw any parallels to what you're seeing today with Mitchell Trubisky? And I know, everyone's going to sit here and say that last week, or 2 weeks ago rather, because the Bears were on the bye this week, that Trubisky was just unbelievable, and that he passed for those six touchdowns, and he had a chance, by the way, to break the Bears record, franchise record, for most touchdown passes in one game. Then the Bears kind of, you know, took their foot off the gas pedal and didn't want Trubisky to do it. But either way, I know, oh my gosh, he had a great game. You know, this is it. He's finally come to be. Well, let me put that game into perspective for you. Now, first of all, we had problems with the Bears in regards to defensively, and I meant the Buccaneers with that. The Buccaneers are the worst defense in the entire NFL. So seeing Trubisky do well and seeing the Nagy offense do well against the Buccaneers is not surprising whatsoever. Seeing Fitzmagic run out, I personally thought was a bit surprising. I thought maybe Fitzpatrick could find a way to continue to anchor that team, but now they've got Jameis Winston back from his domestic dispute suspension, so he'll be back for sure. But anyways, you have Trubisky, he did well, right? And people are starting to jump to conclusions now and say that, oh my goodness, you know, this guy is finally turning in what we thought. The second overall pick can now compete with guys like Patrick Mahomes and Deshaun Watson. But don't get your horses, or don't get too excited, let's put it that way. Don't get so excited about Trubisky and what he's put together. Because just because his record's 3-1, you have to remember, defensively, the Bears are sound, and that contributes to their success, not Trubisky. And I know Trubisky now, you know, he has 8 touchdowns and 3 picks, looking at his stat line, you know, 102 passer rating. Remember, that all stems from that one game. And I feel like throughout the season, it's going to go up and down. Everything's going to fluctuate with his rating and with his completion percentage, with his touchdowns and interceptions. But you have to think, isn't this kind of similar to what Rex Grossman did with the Bears back in 2006. I mean, the Bears as a team, I mean, they remind me of this 2006 team. You've got an okay quarterback, maybe a little less than okay, you know, higher than mediocre, but less than okay, let's put it that way. You've got probably one of the best defenses in the league, I'd say a top five defense, and then you've got a very good running game. And I know Jordan Howard has had some problems getting going. He's having some problems learning this new offense and fitting into it because, as we all know from years past, Jordan Howard is a great running back, a great rusher, but not a good pass-catching back, and that's been his downfall. That's why Tariq Cohen, you're seeing, is getting more snaps for the team this year. But anyways, I digress. I just feel like these two teams from 06 to this year are very similar. I feel like this year with the Bears already jumping out to a 3-1 record, maybe we could see a 9 or 10 win season. I do foresee a playoff appearance for them. I just don't know if it's going to be wild card or if it's going to be the divisional, winning the division, rather. It's too early to tell at this point because right now I know the Vikings and the Packers have gotten off to some rocky starts, but as you know, come the end of the year, those teams are always going to find ways to pick it up. So, you know, you've got many different things going on, but as far as it goes right now, be happy with the Bears and what they're doing, but don't be sold yet on Mitchell Trubisky because, as I mentioned, he has many parallels to Rex Grossman, and I don't know how that's going to end up working out in the long term for Trubisky, but I know something. Don't be sold on his ability just yet. Did you know that monsters could be living under your child's bed or even in the bathtub? For a child with asthma, it can seem like monsters are everywhere, because something as innocent as a teddy bear could trigger their next asthma attack. But there are simple ways you can help, like putting stuffed animals in the freezer to kill dust mites, and drying bath toys to prevent mold. Learn more at noattacks.org or call 1-866-N-O-A-T-T-A-C-S. That's 1-866-NO-ATTACKS, because their next breath is in your hands. That's brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council. Phone lines are open, as I mentioned. If you have any thoughts on the Bears, we could also go back to the Cubs as well. You've got the number, 773-702-8424, 773-702-8424. So let's go back to baseball. Now that we've talked about the Bears and Cubs, let's talk about some national issues. The MLB award season is coming up, and I know everyone's so infatuated with the postseason right now, and that's the right thing to do. But believe it or not, the MLB award season is going to creep up on you, and you're going to realize that you don't know who should win, or you don't have a good opinion on who should win. So my goal right now for these next 10 minutes is to convince you to vote my way, because I feel like there's a lot of discrepancy over who should be winning what. There's a lot of questions over players and their cases in regards to Cy Youngs and MVPs, and I want to set the record straight. I want to clarify what's going on, and I want you to be a well-informed person, and I know you can't vote, but a well-informed person, so when you find out who ends up winning, you'll realize, okay, you know, that was a good choice, or wow, you know, I can't believe that person was chosen. So let's start off with the AL Cy Young Award, and a former Chicago White Sox, by the way, Chris Sale, making some headlines because lots of people think that he should win the award. And I don't want to take away the season that he had because it was impressive. He did go 12-4. His ERA was 2.11. That is insane. Just, you know, the amount, the ERA that he kept playing in the AL East when he has to face teams like the Yankees and, you know, Toronto all the time. Those are quality offensive squads, and he was able to keep his ERA to a minimum. But here's the key argument with Chris Sale. Now, sabermetrically, his WAR is just under 7, so he's still up there, believe it or not, in regards to WAR. But my problem, my number one concern with Chris Sale and his case is his innings total. He's only pitched for 158 innings in one season this year. You know, by the way, just to put that into perspective, he can't even qualify for the ERA title. So even though he has that 2.11 ERA, it doesn't even mean anything because he can't qualify. There's no way he can qualify for the AL ERA lead, and Blake Snell, who we'll get to in a minute, already has a better ERA than him. So what's the point of even worrying about that and, you know, how that works? I mean, I feel like Sale was the favorite earlier in the year, then got hurt and just missed too much time simply. And it's a shame because had Sale been able to keep playing, had Sale been able to maybe go to 180 innings, 185, I could definitely see him with a legitimate case, with, you know, people deciding to vote for him. But because he only pitched 158 innings, I have to let you know that there's no way Chris Sale should be winning the Cy Young Award, plain and simple. And if people decide to vote for him, I'm going to be very, very disappointed in their choices. Now, when you go back to the AL Cy Young, okay, so Chris Sale's out of it, so who are you supposed to think about choosing? Now, in my mind, you got two fields of thought. You've either got an idea of, okay, this person worked hard. This person's a workhorse. They pitched, you know, 220, 230 innings. They had lots of strikeouts. They deserve it because of the innings and the amount of innings that they pitched. And those people right now, it's looking like Justin Verlander and Corey Kluber. And Verlander this year had such a resurgent campaign, a 16-9 record, a 2.52 ERA. Now, here's the key stat. 214 innings pitched, 290 strikeouts. He led the AL. That is impressive. And, you know, it almost looks like, man, we're seeing Verlander back in his prime, like in 2011 when he won the Cy Young and the MVP award. That year he went 24-5. But as a 35-year-old pitcher with 204 wins, he's creeping closer and closer to 300 strikeouts. This guy's going to be a future Hall of Famer and could have lots of consideration coming into this year for the Cy Young. You've also got Corey Kluber. And Kluber this year, well, let's put it this way. He won the Cy Young Award last year. This year, he also had a very good year. Not a great year, but a good year. 20 wins, 7 losses. Now, the problem that's going to beset him is his 2.89 ERA. That's a bit high. And of course, you know, it's a respectable ERA, but in the field, when you're competing against Verlander, who's at 2.52, and then Blake Snell, who we're going to get to next, it doesn't really stand a chance. But Kluber's a guy you can look at. And then we get to my favorite, and even though the innings total is a bit shaky, it's Blake Snell. Snell this year with the Rays, a 7.5 WAR, so he does have an edge there on Sale and Kluber and Verlander. 21-5 record in 31 starts, and a 1.89 ERA, a sizzling ERA. Now, he pitched in 180 and two-thirds innings, so if he did win the Cy Young Award, it'd be the record for the lowest amount of innings pitched to win it. That record was held by Clayton Kershaw back in 2013 when he went 198 and a third, but that year he did go 21-3. He also won the MVP. But anyways, 221 strikeouts in 180 and two-thirds innings. That's dominant. His ERA plus, if you're into sabermetric statistics, that's ERA when taking into effect ballpark considerations, was 219. The league average is 100. So he was 119% above league average in total performance as a pitcher. Blake Snell was the most dominant pitcher in the American League this year. So for that reason, Blake Snell should be winning the AL Cy Young Award. Now, let's go to the NL. And I can't wait to dispel this myth and this idea that Jacob DeGrom is the best player, the best pitcher, rather, in the NL, and that he should be winning this Cy Young Award, because I'm sick and tired of hearing that argument. It gets me so riled up when you hear about a guy, winning 10 games. He's going 10-9, right, with a 1.70 ERA, and people are just starting to say, man, you know what, he is the consensus favorite. There is no doubt in my mind that he should win, because there are two other pitchers, and I could even argue three, depending on your school of thought, who could definitely challenge DeGrom and his case. Now, of course, because everyone's hyped up DeGrom so much, I feel like there's no doubt, there's no going back. He's probably going to win the Cy Young. DeGrom had a good year, don't get me wrong. The 10-9 record does fool some people. His ERA was 1.70, and his ERA plus, by the way, was 2.16. And remember, Snell's was 2.19. So they're actually very similar pitchers, except Snell has 21 wins, and Jacob DeGrom only has 10. Of course, you can attribute that to the Mets' offense and how horrible they were. But 269 strikeouts for DeGrom in 217 innings, an ERA of 1.70. That was a good year, of course it was. But when you're facing off against guys like Max Scherzer, Aaron Nola, Kyle Freeland, it's not going to be a runaway race, and that's what I'm trying to get at. I don't know why there's been this narrative that DeGrom is, 100% going to win. There's no doubt in the world. I don't agree with that at all. Looking at Max Scherzer, now his WAR was 9.5. Jacob DeGrom's was 10.0. So actually, basically, virtually the same WAR, yet everyone sabermetrically is saying that DeGrom is, heaps and bounds better. And I hate that argument. It riles me up knowing that that's the case. And Max Scherzer, by the way, his ERA plus was 168, so not as good. But as far as actual value in WAR, they're the same player. Scherzer this year, 18-7 record, 2.53 ERA. Now, here's the key thing. 300 strikeouts for Max Scherzer. The last to do it was Clayton Kershaw and Chris Sale, but before them, it was Randy Johnson way back in the early 2000s. So, we're seeing something historic this year with this 300 strikeout season, and it's going to be a shame that no one's going to even reward Scherzer for that. And even when Kershaw had his 300 strikeout year, he had to compete against Jake Arrieta, who ended up winning the Cy Young Award with a 22-6 record, and no one cared at the time because of the wins, because of Arrieta's ERA at 1.77. But Don't forget about Scherzer striking, you know, getting 300 strikeouts and going 220 and two-thirds innings. He led the NL in innings, led the NL in strikeouts, led the NL in complete games and shutouts, and then led the NL in wins as well. So, you know, this is interesting, and I feel like people should be realizing the fact that Scherzer is a good player and deserves recognition. We're going to head to the phones here. We got a call on line one. Let's see who it is, and we'll talk some sports with them. Wait 1 second. We're getting them on right now.
Hello, WHPK?
Right here on WHPK.
Oh, yeah, we'll have you on the air in 1 sec.
So we have someone on the air. Let's listen in. Caller, you're on the air. Thank you for calling WHPK 88.5, and what's on your mind? And have we lost them? Maybe. I don't know. We had a caller. Well, anyways, we'll keep talking about the Cy Young Award race. So anyway, you know, DeGrom is the consensus favorite. He'll probably end up winning. But in the end, like I said, there's so many different people you can look at. Doesn't have to be all about Jacob DeGrom. So let's move on now to the AL MVP race, and we're going to have to get through this somewhat quickly, but we will manage. We will find a way to keep you informed. Now, in the AL MVP race, you've got Mookie Betts and Mike Trout, both of them warranting good consideration, but they both missed time due to injury. And I feel like, you know, if I were a voter in the MVP race, I would want someone who would make a difference. Oh, okay. It looks like we've got the caller back on the air, so... Hi there, caller. You're on the air, WHPK 88.5 FM, and what's on your mind?
How you doing, man? It's Q calling in.
Hey, Quentin Richardson. How you doing, man? Well, we'll get to that right now. So let me give this guy an intro. Quentin Richardson on the phone. So today's guest grew up right here in the city of Chicago, playing high school basketball, winning a state championship at Whitney Young. He then played collegiately at DePaul for 2 seasons, winning the Conference USA Player of the Year Award in 1999. He was drafted by the Los Angeles Clippers in the first round of the 2000 NBA draft, and he spent 13 years in the NBA, leading the league in three-point field goals during the 04-05 season. This year, he's a Jordan Brand ambassador and a part of POWER, the reigning Big Three basketball champions. Please welcome Quentin Richardson to the show. Quentin, thank you for being here, man. How are you?
I'm great, man. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about that for a minute. I talked about Big Three, you know, your success with POWER and with the Big Three. You guys had a star-studded lineup, featured you, Ketino Mobley, Corey Maggette, who won the MVP of the league, plus the Hall of Fame head coach, Nancy Lieberman. How'd you guys end up pulling it off this year?
Man, we definitely had a great group of guys, man. Birdman Anderson, Ryan Gomes, Xavier Silas, Big Baby Davis, Ketino, Corey, myself, and Coach Lieberman was unbelievable, man. She came in, she was focused, she was about winning, and she took it seriously, man. We were well coached, we were ready, we had game plans and plays, and we pulled it off, man. We had a great team and we got it done.
And what do you have to say about having, you know, Lieberman as a head coach? He's already a Hall of Famer, you know, one of the greatest to ever play the game. So what was it like for you to have her as your coach personally?
It was great, man. It was great getting to know her. She's a great person, really, really great person. She knows the game of basketball. She's as detailed as any coach I played for in the NBA. And that's the bottom line, man. Regardless of gender or anything, she knows the game of basketball. She loves the game of basketball. She has a great, great passion to teach it. And she did a great job coaching us, man. I can't say enough about it. My daughter, she loves her. My daughter was amazed. I got a 5-year-old daughter. She was amazed that we had as my daughter said, we have a girl as a coach. I've never seen a girl as a coach, so she was really excited about that. And it was just a great experience, man. A great experience. Still talk to Nancy every other day, a week or so. So it's just great.
You know, take me through that the championship game, because you had to face Baron Davis and True Gooden. I mean, both of those guys were great NBA players, you know, in their day. And the game itself was a back-and-forth battle. How much did it mean to you to overcome that and then end up winning the Big Three championship?
I think, you know, if you ask any athlete, any player, anybody who's competed at any level, I mean, you know, for me, it's I always want to win. And, I mean, for me to have a chance to, you know, post-NBA career anything. I hadn't really won a championship when I think about it since prior to my college when I went and played on the Olympic team and, you know, and won the gold medal and won in high school. So outside of that, this is like seriously like the first championship. I mean, you know, we all compete. We all want to win. We all want to win, you know, titles or medals or whatever it is. So anytime you can win something like that and win a championship, it's an awesome feeling, man. And I mean, for a lot of us, you know, we got the champagne shower and all that. It was just a great experience, man. Ice Cube was unbelievable with putting this together. And just watching him from week to week, he was fully committed. He was there with his wife and his family. He was there, like, you know, the game would be on Friday. We generally got in Thursday and got out Saturday or Sunday. Cube would be there early in the week, Monday or Tuesday, hitting the ground, hitting the radio stations, TV stations, in the community, promoting and trying to get the buzz about it and get people to come out. So, I mean, I definitely take my hat off and salute Cube, not only for, you know, creating this format as the Big Three, but just the way he's committed to being involved and really pushing it himself. That was unbelievable to see his commitment to it and to the whole league and all of us guys.
You know, you mentioned the champagne showers, and I remember I watched on your Instagram stories you guys celebrated, and rightfully so, of course. But do you have any, you know, crazy championship stories, anything funny that ended up happening on the flight home and during your celebration?
Well, I think the you know, like I say, the whole thing was a great experience, and it was super fun. But I think the best part for most of us, I know for me, the trophy left from the podium, and it never left our hands. We took it out to eat after the game. We took it out to the club with us in the club. Then we left from the club, and it actually went. It came home with me. I took it home to the hotel that night. Got up. Flew with it, walked through the airport and everything. And the best, one of the funniest parts was that, like you said, myself and Drew, we were against each other. We were opponents, but we both are neighbors. Like, literally, Drew lives directly across the street from me in my neighborhood. Literally, we both live in Orlando, so he lives directly across the street. So we actually flew on the same flight together and sat right next to each other with the trophy the entire flight home. And I actually copped the ride with him and rode home with him to the neighborhood. So that's literally a true story.
Oh my goodness, that must have for him at least, that must have been horrible, having to sit there and watch you carry the trophy around and split cabs with him. And now every day you see him, you know, I would start displaying that trophy in your window and, you know, showing it off every day.
Well, it was all in good fun, man. Drew was a great sport about it. We laughed and cracked a lot of jokes about it, because like while we were in the airport, you know, everybody was coming up and they didn't know, you know, they thought we had won the trophy together. And, you know, he was like, no, his team beat my team. And he was like, nah, we got to ride together. So it was all in good fun. But, you know, Drew's my boy. So it was a great time.
Quentin Richardson here on Sports Talk Chicago and WHBK 88.5 FM. And Quentin, let's move to some NBA news, especially as the season gets underway this month. Now, first off, I wanted to get your thoughts on Jimmy Butler and his trade request to Miami. Do you see that getting done before the season starts, and what are your thoughts on Butler requesting the trade?
As far as it getting done, you never really know, man. Those things, it takes a lot of different things and a lot of moving parts to come together for something like that to get pulled off, especially when it's already so public and so known. So I don't really know whether it's going to get done or how that's going to play out. But as far as the request, I mean, more and more we starting to see this all the time. When guys are, you know, regardless of whether they're under contract or how many more years or how much time they have, when things go a certain way or when certain things go down, you know, you start to see some of the stars, they request or they make demands to force their way out. And I think that's been going that way for some time now. So I'm, you know, I don't know the ins and outs to what happened in that scenario, but am I surprised by a star saying, hey, demanding a trade? No, I'm not.
Do you agree with that idea? Because I know when you played, you know, it was a different league. Now you've got maybe players with more power and more means of requesting trades and getting things done. Do you agree with the way Butler has handled the situation?
For me, it's from the outside looking in, I would take caution as to trying to, you know, me as a foreign player, I would not try to speak on something that I'm not informed about. So, I mean, I don't want to say that I look at it any kind of way. I'm not informed enough to sit there and say, hey, Jimmy's right or wrong or this is that, because I don't know what conversations have been had intimately with him and those in the organization or him and his teammates or any of that. It's a myriad of things that could have, you know, that led him to this decision. I mean, especially right before camp. That's why I have to think that something had to happen. It wasn't just, oh, we're going along, going on, and we're going to do it. Then it just changes right before camp. Something had to happen, and I don't know what that is, so it's hard for me to comment on that to say, hey, Jimmy's wrong or anybody's wrong, because depending on what happened, hey, man, things happen, and you don't want to be in that situation anymore, so you have to do what you have to do. So I think, you know, we have to be respectful and not knowing what's going on before we make a judgment about either party or either side.
You know, I wanted to go more into this season because there have been so many players, you know, on the move. You got LeBron now on the Lakers, Kawhi to the Raptors, DeMarcus Cousins now on the Warriors. So what are your thoughts on this upcoming season, and which teams do you think will make an impact?
For me, it's always exciting, man. I'm a huge fan of the league, always going to be watching. I mean, when you see movement and things like that, I mean, that just lets you know that it'll be some change and some shift in the power. I mean, the East is wide open, although the Celtics, you know, seem like the front runners and what have you. But I mean, the East is open with LeBron going to the West. The West is now, you know, really the wild, wild West with LeBron heading West and moving a balance of power again. I mean, there's just so many different ways you think about the effects of the players moving, like who's going to be all-stars. Somebody's going to get pushed out. Now you have more openings kind of in the East, but in the West it's going to be kind of like somebody's going to be the odd man left out because there's so many talented players over there.
And speaking of this season as well, I know that Dwayne Wade, another Chicago native, someone you know well, came out and said that this will be his final season in the NBA. So what do you think about that?
I'm just happy for him, man. I had a chance to talk to him probably about a month before he made the, you know, the final decision. But I kind of felt that was what he was going to do. And I'm just happy for him, man. I couldn't be more proud of everything he's accomplished. In my eyes, he's, you know, right behind MJ and Kobe as shooting guards go in the NBA history. So, I mean, he's done things that nobody ever could have dreamed he was going to do. He's a first ballot Hall of Famer on the court and off the court. He continues to, you know, to push his brand and become bigger. He does amazing things in the community. He helps the youth. I mean, what can you say? I mean, he deserves everything he's getting. He deserves a swan song of 1 year. He's one of the guys that will be celebrated as he goes around. It won't be some of the craziest, because D-Wade is a genuine good guy. People like him. People know him. He's a humble dude. He's always giving back, and he continues to do that. So, I mean, those are the guys that you cheer for and you want to see get their last dance and those different things like that, because he's such a good guy. He's earned it.
Now, I wanted to go more so to today, talk about some news with you. You were recently featured in a video for the Players Tribune, which I found powerful and amazing. I got a chance to watch it. I loved it. Just so insightful. I wanted to go back to when you talked about your brother and what happened in the video. How difficult was that for you to overcome, knowing that, you know, your brother wouldn't be around anymore? And how emotional was it for you to go back to the place in which he was murdered?
For me, it was at the time, that was definitely probably one of the biggest challenges and one of the more difficult times in my life. Even when I lost, you know, family when I was younger at 12, that I would say that losing my brother later in life when I was 25, 26 years old, I think that was more difficult just because you're an adult, you understand things more. I had much more time. I was closer with my brother and things like that. So I think that was probably definitely more difficult. But I mean, as far as like going back for the video, I have been back there several times since everything happened. But I mean, as far as standing out there and standing right there in the area that everything happened and actually going over and talking about it, that was kind of emotional. I felt that a little bit after the, you know, as I was doing that in the video and afterwards riding away, it was kind of, you know, I felt some emotions about that. But you know, it's a part of life, man. I felt like it was kind of therapeutic to stand there and be able to talk about it out loud. You know, the other previous times that I was there, I was there by myself, and, you know, I was just thinking different things. And every time I go home, I always, you know, ride by my old house where we grew up at some point before I get in or out. I try and get through there. So that was one of the few times that I literally, like I say, got out, stood there, walked around the house. And like I say, this is so many years removed, and just to be there at the house and see some of the things are still exactly the same. The pole sticking out of the ground from the pole that my pops had put, you know, put our basketball rim in our driveway, like the top of the bottom of the pole is still cemented in the ground, all rusted at the top from where it's been tore down, but like the pole is still there. You know, seeing the house looking the same, and, you know, not change crazily a lot. And it's just, you know, brought back a lot of memories from childhood, from growing up, and things like that. Cause like I said, usually when I go, I just ride by, you know, just checking out the house. I don't really stop or sit there. That was one of the few times that I got out, stood there, walked around, talked about things, reminisced a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that just must have been, you know, such an emotional moment. And, you know, you are a native Chicagoan, too, so I know, you know, you've been in the area, and it was documented in the video. How much does that mean to you, being a native Chicagoan and then coming back? Because I know that, you know, you mentioned in the video that you played for Los Angeles back early in your career with the Clippers, and every year at the end of the year, during your exit interview, you end it, and then you come straight back home and live here in Chicago. So what does it mean to you to be a native Chicagoan and, you know, being a part of this city?
Man, I wear it with a badge of honor. I mean, anybody that knows me, they all know that I'm from Chicago. At some point, that comes up, and because I bleed it. You know, everything, I'm very proud to be from Chicago, and I feel like we different to anybody else. And I feel like when I go out, I'm going to make that be known. I've done that forever. I've got Chicago, you know, tattooed on my body, and it's embedded in my character, the way I speak. I speak on it proudly. I'm always, you know, when you meet new people and everybody's talking, I'm from Chicago. And, you know, I say it and pause and wait for the reaction, because I know there's one going to come, because everybody knows, you know, you gotta be something. You gotta have some substance in you and some character if you come from Chicago and you really, you know, you succeed and you make it out of there. And then, you know, there's a story and there's some character there, because Chicago is a tough, hard city.
And before we let you go today, Quentin, I know that yesterday was your father's birthday, and I'm guessing that you probably got him another train set for the occasion, but how was it to spend some time with him yesterday?
I'm actually in Orlando, so I didn't get to spend any time with him, but I visited with him on the phone and got him on the FaceTime deal with all of the kids and all of his grandkids, saying happy birthday to him after he got home from church. So, you know, that was a good time, and you know, just getting to talk to the old man and holler at him and hear him having a good time, that was good enough for me. And he'll be down here to visit in a few weeks anyway, so.
Well, Quentin, thank you so much for being here today. Had a great time, as always, and hope to have you on again soon.
All right, man. Thanks for having me, John. Appreciate it.
That was Quentin Richardson. You know, great NBA player, great guy. We talked to him, too, about being a native Chicagoan and then overcoming, you know, the things he had to overcome. His brother being senselessly murdered in the Chicago area, and that's what we were alluding to later in that interview. So a great story, great guy, so happy he took some time to come here on the show. Now, I did promise earlier in the show, and I know, you know, the schedule kind of got a little dicey, a podcast montage. And this is going to be a 10-minute montage of what I put together, just some compilations, some interviews that I've done in the past, some funny moments. We've got lots of laughs, lots of serious, hard-hitting questions. We're going to play that for you right now. We'll come back and sign off. And again, you're listening to 88.5 WHPK FM, Chicago. Please welcome the great Warren Sapp to the show. Warren, how are you doing today? And thank you for taking the time to be on the show.
I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me.
And once the time ran out, what did it feel like to be crowned a Super Bowl champion, especially the way you guys started and the way you came in the NFL with all of the misery in Tampa Bay? What did it feel like to cap that all off with the Super Bowl championship in 2002?
It's something that could never be taken away from you. We're champions forever. forever and a day, they have to say Super Bowl champion, world champion. They have to say it. That like put that hat on, my man. When I walked to the sideline after Brooks ran that touchdown in, being him over there, he go to crying. I said, "Don't make me cry." Yeah. So I push him away from me. I look up, and somebody's got a hat. Oh, I know it. Ellis Williams got it. Big dog. And he got his hat on. I said, "You got a hat on?" And he looked at me. He said, "I got you one." I said, "Well, that's what I'm talking about right there, baby. You got the big dog hat." I said, "Hey, I'm done." I gave my helmet up at that point, and it was over right there. I was a world champion. I had my hat on.
Please welcome Michael Vick to the show. So I wanted to go to 2007 and at the height of your career. Now, you pleaded guilty to federal charges involving a dogfighting investigation and served 18 months in prison. So what I wanted to ask you is, you know, what was that time like for you, and what life lessons did you learn, and how did you overcome that experience to come out strong and end up playing, you know, many more years in the NFL?
Yeah, a lot of that time was spent on just trying to figure out, you know, how to make amends and right my wrongs. And, you know, I think, you know, what it all initially starts with is forgiving yourself for being put in that situation or putting yourself in that situation and then having to suffer the consequences when you disappoint so many people. So I was able to forgive myself and let it go. And then, you know, figure out a plan moving forward within that 18-month time span. And, you know, to be able to think for that long, you almost have no choice but to come out and be successful.
Please welcome the Rocket, Roger Clemens, to the show.
My nickname has changed a little bit from Rocket to Poppy Rocket. My oldest boy, Kobe, had twin boys, so we're getting them going.
A report came out compiled by Senator Mitchell regarding performance-enhancing drug use in Major League Baseball. Now, your name was involved in the report, and you had to testify in front of Congress. There are some people who suspect that you used PEDs or other steroids. Now, I'd just like to get your side of the story on the issue. What are your thoughts on all of that?
Well, I've already told my side of the story on that, and we've already proved my case, so that's a done deal. So we basically stopped the guy from out there trying to make a little money off of us and running around telling people a number of different things. But we got in a fair setting, and we deal with just facts, and the facts came out, and what we knew would come out came out, and it worked out the way we wanted it. It was trying and taxing on a lot of people, but like I said, when you have somebody out there telling lies about certain people and you have family that it hurts and a number of other people, you handle it the proper way, and that's exactly what we did.
Now, you mentioned the money there. Do you feel that your name was included because of money and because of publicity, or because the report found something noteworthy? Mostly the money is what I'm hearing from you. Is that correct?
We stopped the guy from making money off our name, basically, is what we did. It had nothing to do with anything else. That's all it was, and it was pretty much a dog and pony show of everybody that everybody watched it in the comments that I got from everybody.
Please welcome Devin Hester to the show. Devin, how are you doing today, and thank you for being here on the show. It's an honor.
I appreciate it, man, and I'm doing great.
How hard was it for you to walk away from the game after such an amazing career, and how much did it mean to you to retire as a Bear?
It meant a lot for me to retire as a Bear. You know, that's where I spent majority of my career. And I told those guys, you know, Ted and George McCaskey and all those guys, and I told them that, you know, regardless of how we left, parted ways in my career in Chicago, you know, my heart, and I will always bleed a Chicago Bear. And that as soon as I'm done playing football, I would love to come back and retire as a Bear.
Please welcome Charles Peanut Tillman to the show. Charles, how are you doing today? And thank you for being here on the show.
I'm doing good, man. Thanks for having me. I can't complain.
And I know that in the Bears' preseason game against Denver, Cravon LeBlanc forced a fumble, and the announcing team called it the Peanut Punch. This kind of immortalizes you in a way. What are your thoughts on that?
You know what? It's pretty good to leave your mark on the game. I didn't think that I would get credit for all the forced fumbles that are out there, or a lot of the forced fumbles that are out there. But I guess I did something all right. I did something good. If you know, announcers, when two other teams are playing and I'm retired, and they still refer to it as the Peanut Punch. So I guess I did something all right.
Please welcome Braylon Edwards to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And sticking with the NFL today, I also wanted to get your thoughts on the league's new national anthem policy. What are your impressions on it and the protests themselves?
Well, you know, we started with Colin Kaepernick and the protest. I think the NFL could have did a better job, and Roger Goodell, the owners as well, they could have did a better job of nipping in the bud right away. Colin made a silent protest. Colin explained to us why he made that protest. He just was very unhappy with the injustices going on as it related to young black men or black people in general and the police. So he took a knee. Right then and there was the NFL's chance to say, hey, pull Colin to the side. Say, hey, we understand why you're doing this. And then come out publicly and support his cause. The problem with NFL is you got to support the player's causes. Okay, just support his, to support his cause out in the open. Say, hey, you know, we support Colin and we support why he's protesting. But then behind closed doors, you talk to the players and say, hey, we'll do our job and we'll do something to create a charity fund for the, you know, the victims and family members, or we'll create more awareness like the NBA does, like the MLB does. But they never did that. So it went from 2015 or 16. It went from 16. Now it's carried over to 17. And now it's carried over to 18.
We're talking with Jason Richardson here on Sports Talk Chicago. You know, I have to ask, because that very next year, you pulled off the impossible by performing a between-the-legs reverse finish. How long did it take for you to master that dunk? How much planning and practicing was involved before you showed it off in front of everyone?
Well, it was a lot of planning going on. You know, my second year doing the dunk contest, I kind of ran out of dunks. A teammate of mine, Gilbert Arenas, always had these crazy ideals of doing dunks. And some of these dunks, I was like, Gilbert, there's no way in the world that could be pulled off unless you jumped off the trampoline. He said, trust me, just try it. And I tried it one time, and I knew I missed it. But I knew it was going to be a dunk that I could do once I was in the dunk contest setting. The crowd was there, the anticipation, the adrenaline. I knew I could complete the dunk once I got to the NBA dunk contest. And when I did it in that dunk contest the second time around, that was the first time I actually completed that dunk.
Wow, that's so interesting. I wouldn't have known. You know, it looked like you had just practiced it for so long, and it looked so perfect that you wouldn't have thought that that was the first time you actually made it.
No, it was the first time I actually made it, and I think I attempted again one time in China maybe a year or two later, and I could never complete that dunk ever again in my life. It was just one of those dunks that, you know, you're drilling, pumping, the crowd is a, you know, want to see something spectacular. I needed a spectacular dunk to win the dunk contest, and I pulled it off.
We're talking to Tom Waddle here on Sports Talk Chicago, and I wanted to ask you about your conversation with Stephen A. Smith on First Take back in 2017. I mean, I have to say, you really told him off. Describe the incident, and how did you feel after owning that conversation?
Well, you know, I mean, it's funny. First of all, Stephen is one of my favorite people in the business. He's very talented, a hard worker, and off the air, he's one of the nicest guys I've come in contact with in this industry. So my goal wasn't to try to create any type of controversy. He was just asking me a question about a much-debated situation here in Chicago with Jay Cutler, and, you know, it wasn't a situation where I was trying to say, hey, Stephen, I've played and you haven't, so I'm right and you're wrong. It was me just basically saying, he asked me how my listeners in Chicago feel about me when I support Jay Cutler, and I just told him I think they trust me because I played the game.
Kevin Harlan here on Sports Talk Chicago. Going back to 2015 during a Bulls and Lakers game, you were sitting courtside calling the action for TNT when all of a sudden the ball had gotten knocked away and it somehow found you on the sideline. What was really funny about this moment is that you ended up calling the play-by-play action of the ball flying into your face. Take me through what happened there.
Well, you know, we're courtside, luckily and fortunately, and so that gives us a very good view. And the ball flew in and kind of caught me in the headset and the head. And normally, you know, when you're hit by a ball or a flying player diving for a ball, you know, the security or the guys that are manning the areas for the court will rush over to make sure you're okay. And so kind of jokingly, and I wasn't really even hit in the head, but jokingly said, I'm fine, I'm okay, don't worry about me, I'm good, and something that probably the average fan would say if they were on, you know, in the same position on the court at the same time and something like that would happen to them.
And thank you so much for being here on the show today. It was an unbelievable pleasure to have you on. Thank you.
No, my pleasure, my brother. I love your show. And anytime you want me back, you give us a buzz.
John, always great following your career. I know we've got conversations ahead of us, and I'll look forward to those in the future. But congratulations on your great start, and I really appreciate the chance to visit with you today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. And I'm sorry I yelled at you about Joey Votto and Chase Utley, but but don't listen to Mad Dog, please. Don't do that anymore.
No, I won't for sure. Thank you.
Thank you, man. Take care.
You too. So that was the compilation that I put together, all of my podcasts, you know, some of the interviews rather. So lots of funny moments, lots of really good stuff. And this is what you'll be seeing every week here on 88.5 and every week on my website at sportstalkchicago.com. So make sure to check that out when you get an opportunity. So anyways, that does it for me. I'll be here next week again, Monday from 9 to 10 a.m. on right here, 88.5 WHPK-FM. You can find me on Twitter at John Z Sports, on Instagram at John Zags, LinkedIn at John Zagluel, and Facebook at John Zagluel. A special thank you again to Quentin Richardson for calling in today. Very powerful, very fun interview. And right now, we're going to go to music, and we're having a new show.